From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk about the state of American theater with Robert Brustein. He's the founder of the Yale Repertory Theater, is founding director of Harvard's American Repertory Theater, and is theater critic for the New Republic. If you saw the movie Chan is Missing, you probably remember the cook with the Samurai Night Fever t-shirt who sang Fry Me to the Moon. The cook was played by Peter Wong. Wong is now a director. Coming up, we talk about his new comic thriller, The Laser Man. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the British ska movement. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new memoir by presidential speechwriter Peggy Noonan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. U.S. officials say despite a strong U.S. plea, the Soviet Union is unwilling to renew diplomatic relations with Israel or begin direct flights of Jewish immigrants to Tel Aviv. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the administration is still hopeful it can happen. Both issues were raised by Secretary of State James Baker with Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze during talks in Moscow 2 weeks ago. Colombia's National Liberation Army guerrillas have declared war on U.S. interests in Colombia, threatening to attack the U.S. ambassador and military advisors. Radio reports today said a U.S. priest released by the guerrillas yesterday carried the ominous warning. Leslie Werpson, Bogota, reports.
The National Liberation Army, or ELN guerrillas, say the top two targets on their list for violent attacks are the U.S. ambassador and U.S. military advisors in Colombia. Next in line are North American spies and U.S. business interests. Radio reports said U.S. priest Francisco Ferrari was the bearer of the ELN's communique. The guerrillas kidnapped Father Ferrari and two more U.S. citizens last week to protest President George Bush's visit here. The ELN said U.S. military advisors are promoting the dirty war against Colombia's left-wing politicians and grassroots organizations. The ELN is the most violent of Colombia's five major guerrilla organizations. The rebels commonly blow up oil pipelines, protesting the participation of multinational companies in the oil industry. Police said the rebels bombed five police posts yesterday and an electrical tower in the northern city of Cartagena, wounding five policemen. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wipsa in Bogota.
The White House confirmed today that the Department of Agriculture is studying the possibility of using caterpillars that eat coca plants as a tool in the drug war. That and other possibilities are being researched in part because the U.S. has backed away from its earlier reliance on defoliants to kill coca crops. NPR's Jim Engel has more.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the research on herbicides and natural enemies of coca and other drug plants is experimental. No potential weapon would be considered for use until it has been proven safe and effective, he said. We're not undertaking a biological war, he added. Neither troops nor caterpillars will go into another country without consultation and a request from the host nation. Some environmental groups complained coca growers already spray pesticides to kill the caterpillars and that introducing more of them would only increase the use of pesticides and therefore possible damage to the environment. Fitzwater said, in any case, there is a general move away from eradication of coca crops in favor of voluntary crop substitution. The eradication program, he said, has not been that effective. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 39 points to close at 2596.85. This is NPR News. Cuba and Angola have agreed to resume the withdrawal of Cuban forces from Angola. The Cuban pullout was suspended last month after UNITA rebels attack in which four Cubans were killed. The Cuban news agency says the pullout will resume next Sunday. Cuban and Angolan officials say they will hold the United States responsible for any further attacks on Cuban troops by the U.S.-backed UNITA rebels. In East Berlin today, financial experts started discussing details of an economic and monetary union between the two Germanies. The commission agreed to wrap up preliminary work before East German elections are held next month. Deidre Berger reports from West Berlin.
The planned economic and monetary union started taking shape today after weeks of resistance from the banking community and hesitations by the East German government. East German leader Hans Modrow today warned again it is necessary to provide a social services net to cushion the impact of the union. Introducing West German marks into East Germany is expected to create large-scale unemployment and higher prices. In the East German parliament today, Modrow said social justice must accompany the process of German unity. The East German leader suggested talks on reunification get underway immediately. He said it is imperative for both Germanys to sign a declaration recognizing the current Polish-German border. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
Government officials in Nepal say police fired on pro-democracy protesters who tried to burn down a police station. At least three demonstrators were killed. A ministry statement said so far 11 people have been killed since Sunday, the first day of a nationwide demonstration against a 29-year-old ban on political parties. The Yugoslavian government today sent additional tanks and troops to the southern Kosovo province. Ethnic Albanians are clashing with authorities in an effort to gain greater autonomy. I'm Doreen McAllister. National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Brustein has made an impact on American theater as a critic, producer, director, and teacher. In 1966, Brustein became the dean of the Yale School of Drama. He established the Yale Repertory Theater and served as its artistic director for 13 years. From Yale, he went to Harvard, where he created the American Repertory Theater, which he continues to direct. The celebrated alumni of the Harvard and Yale programs include Christopher Walken, Sigourney Weaver, Christopher Durang, and Meryl Streep. Christopher Lloyd is starring in Brustein's current production of Strindberg's The Father. In Brustein's capacity as theater critic for The New Republic, Brustein has taken many provocative positions. In a review of one of Václav Havel's plays several years ago, Brustein wrote that he was reluctant to write about Havel's work because political considerations can inhibit one's critical judgments. While Havel's status recently changed from dissident playwright to the president of Czechoslovakia, he's in Washington this week to meet with President Bush and address a joint session of Congress. I asked Robert Brustein if he sees Havel's rise to power as a statement about the political relevance of art and artists.
I think that in Europe, there's always been a significant relevance to art and artists. Clearly, European countries and the Soviet Union has responded quite violently to the dicta and conclusions of artists and quite often has imprisoned them, which signifies the power of the written word over there. I don't think in this country we've as yet achieved anywhere near the potency of art in relation to the society that we live in.
Now, from what I've read of yours, you're actually not a big fan of Havel's plays.
Well, I respect and admire them. I think that the political component in them does tend at times, I won't say to get didactic, but that he is such a heroic figure, and he is quite often the hero of his own work, that he must work extra hard not to turn himself into a self-adulating figure. He does that with extreme deftness, but you feel the contortions that he's going through in order to make his point about the repressiveness of the society and yet not heroicize himself in relation to that society. So he goes into pretzel contortions doing that, and as a result, I think that may have affect the disinterestedness of the work.
I think a lot of us have become very curious about Havel's work, and I think most Americans haven't read it or seen it performed. Would you give us like a basic introduction to his plays?
Well, it's hard to give a little capsule version of his plays, but and I haven't read all of them, to tell you the truth, but the ones I know generally do follow fairly much in the pattern of Beckett, to whom he pays homage, and it's significant that Beckett pays homage to Havel as well. I don't know of any other writer that he does that he did that in relation to. Insofar as his work generally takes place in one of two places, either unspecified, vague location where there is a repression going on, and a group of secret policemen, say, are trying to batter down a door and interrogate an individual inside the room, or in the specified Czechoslovakian living room or prison where Havel himself has spent a good deal of time. And I think it's safe to say that virtually all of his plays have to do with how one responds inside a repressive society, not just the artist, but any individual. and what you do when your friends are caving into that repression and collaborating with it.
In a review that you wrote a couple of years ago of one of his plays, and it was a play that you were critical of, you wrote that it was really a dilemma. How does one criticize the art of an exemplary man?
Yes, one has this problem with Fugard as well. I think they're very similar. Athol Fugard, the South African, and Havel, the Czechoslovakian writers, both are what I call saints of the theater. They're very saintly human beings, and the work they're doing has a very powerful moral and political purpose. But obviously, I think that it falls short of being great art, perhaps as a result of the fact that the purpose is overwhelmingly moral and political rather than artistic.
Would you be likely to stage Havel now, given how he's become president of his country, or would you make that decision purely on what you thought of the play?
I think we'd have to, which is not to say we don't do plays that that are relevant to one's particular time and place. It's very important that we do that kind of play. But I wouldn't do any play simply because someone has become president of the country. I wouldn't do the plays of the Pope, for example, simply because he writes plays as well. I think we would have to feel that the play was an important one for our company and for our audience. And for that reason, other than its convenience at the time, that would be the best reason to put it on. And I'm sure Havel's going to get innumerable productions now all over the country and will be possibly the most well-produced playwright in America over the next year or two.
One more question about Havel. Has Havel's work been very popular in Eastern Europe or in the States here?
Well, as far as I know, Havel's work has not been done in Eastern Europe. There's any number of plays that he's written that he's never seen himself. He just went, I think, to Finland to see the first production of one of his plays. It wasn't the first production of the play, but for him, it was the first time he'd ever seen the play. His plays have been done, not very often in the United States. I think the public theater, Joe Papp's Public Theater, is taking the lead in staging his plays. They are generally received with respect, but not a great deal of enthusiasm or popularity. That is undoubtedly destined to change.
Are you cynical when you say that?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
I'm not being cynical. Naturally, I think that a playwright's work should be determined on the basis of its quality rather than any circumstances surrounding the playwright. But Havel certainly deserves to be seen, and so any way he can get his plays seen, I'm fully in favor of.
Now, you've staged some political theater in your time, even in the late 60s when you were first at the Yale Repertory Theater. You did McBird and Viet Rock, two anti-war plays. And in a book you wrote about that period, you described them as maybe politically shallow, but important cathartic experiences. How did you weigh that, if you thought the plays were lacked a certain political depth, but they'd really matter in the lives of the people who saw it?
Well, first a correction. We did not produce McBird. That was produced off-Broadway in 1966.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me.
Not at all, but we did produce Viet Rock, that did not turn out to be quite as textured as I had hoped it might be and as I thought it was going to be from the studio work I'd seen preparatory to the actual full production. My own feeling in answer to your question is that I think virtually every great play has some political component, and you can't escape it. The question is whether the political, the ideological component becomes its overriding purpose, and if the art or the complexity or the subtlety of the presentation takes a back seat to the ideology, however appropriate or satisfying that ideology may be to certain people. I think it's not destined to last if the ideology is paramount, if the thematic thrust is paramount and it's not supported by sufficient artistic tie beams.
Robert Brustein is my guest, and he's the founder and artistic director of the American Repertory Theater at Harvard. He also founded the Yale Repertory Theater, and his current production at the American Repertory Theater is Strindberg's The Father, which will run through March 18th. Many artists and writers and people and nonprofit arts groups are concerned that the National Endowment for the Arts has become politicized. There's a new guideline for NEA applications saying that the NEA can't fund work that's considered obscene, including sadomasochism, homoeroticism, the sexual exploitation of children or individuals engaged in sex acts, unless the material has serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Do you consider that censorship? And do you think that, well, let you answer that question first.
I do consider that borderline censorship. I think it is an infringement of First Amendment rights, and I know there are people who will dispute this, saying that you're not censoring a play simply if you're not funding it, or any work of art. But in our country, since it's so hard to find funds for works of art, and since the National Endowment was founded precisely for the purpose of providing money to artists who normally could not get it through commercial means, since they're not creating entertainment or popular works, I think this does de facto function as a form of censorship and infringement of the First Amendment right.
What does serious artistic value mean to you? I mean, there is that clause, you know, that the NEA won't fund this stuff unless the materials have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value.
I think it's a contradiction in terms. If whatever is considered obscene is inside a work of art, then it has artistic value. It seems like a redundancy to me, or a tautology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who determines this, how it's determined. It seems to me that we're setting up a whole number of literary critics and critics of art among people who have no experience of it. They're not qualified. They're not trained to criticize art. I mean, Jesse Helms is hardly our most advanced art critic, nor are any other members of Congress that I know. And certainly the Supreme Court is not in a position to make these determinations. The best judge of the quality of the art and its social purpose is the panel group that functions in each of the NEA divisions that determines whether the institution or the artist is worthy of receiving a grant. And that's a panel group of peers made up of a large number of variety of people from the arts and surrounding areas. And I still know of no better method than the peer group review by the panels. And to take the authority away from the panels, I think, is seriously to undermine the authority of the NEA and one's confidence in it as a functioning institution.
You disagree with the validity of this new guideline. You at least once served on an NEA panel. Would you serve again as long as this guideline remains?
No, I would not. Frankly, I would find this a highly restrictive guideline, and I think it's an insulting guideline to a number of artists as well. It's infantile, and it has put us back about, God knows, 30 or 40 years in our standing in relation to other nations. We're just looking like a bunch of adolescents here, where our values and our morality is determined by network television and its values and morality.
Are there plays that you've staged in the past that you think might be challenged now because of sadomasochism, homoeroticism? You know.
Well, I think that guideline, which is a revised version of the Helms Amendment, Sidney Yates introduced the proviso that this have, you know, literary or scientific or artistic value. But nevertheless, to put homoerotic art in with sadomasochism and mutilation of children and God knows what else they've got there as a list of criminal intents, I think is a serious insult to the homosexual community. Certainly there are plays that we have done that have included homosexuals or been about homosexuals or been written by homosexuals, which we consider works of considerable merit. We are about to do a play by Arthur Kopit that I think is one of the funniest plays I've read in many years, called The Road to Nirvana, and that undoubtedly will break just about every rule that has been set down by this amendment, outside of the fact that it has artistic value, it has great artistic value. But I think all our hands will be tied if we have to adjudicate every work of art we get according to guidelines. Artists don't function this way, and I fear that the way they're going to respond is to get more provocative rather than less. I mean, that's what one tends to do when one gets painted into a corner. You get provocative. You start waving a red flag at the people who obviously start salivating when they see one.
You say you fear that artists will get more provocative. What would be wrong with that? Why do you fear it?
Well, I don't think this is the nature of, you know, I think we were off on a detour. It's not the nature of our work to go around provoking Jesse Helms and his ilk. It really debases and lowers the aspirations of the artist and brings him down to the level of a very second-rate Puritan.
Well, tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Robert Brustein. He's the founder and artistic director of the American Repertory Theater at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's also the founder of Yale Repertory Theater. He founded it when he was the dean of the Yale Drama School. Brustein also writes theater reviews for The New Republic and has written several books about theater. And his current production is Strindberg's The Father, which will run through March 18th. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Talking about theater, and my guest is Robert Brustein. You've written, in my profession, there's nothing more alienating than going to a smash hit and not being able to share the good time that everyone seems to be having. Has that happened to you lately?
It happens fairly frequently, yes. Generally at the Socceroo, what I call schleppic musicals that Broadway's been turning out lately.
give me a recent example.
Oh, Phantom of the Opera, I guess, is a good example. Cats. I'm not among the majority that respond to those ear-shaking musicals. I find the music is unsatisfying. It sounds like Puccini combined with Parmesan cheese. And the books are generally fatuous and silly. It doesn't please me to sit and watch chandeliers go up and down, which seems to be the main actor in this particular work.
So what's so alienating about not liking something when everybody around you is enjoying themselves like crazy?
Well, one of the great things about the theater is that it is a community. It's one of the last communities we have left. And it's interesting, you know, when you go to the theater, you don't want the seat next to you to be empty. You want to be next to somebody, which is different from when you want to go to the movies where you want a whole theater to yourself. You don't want anyone sitting next to you because you want to be alone with your fantasies. But in the theater, you really want to be part of something. You want to respond together. There's a kind of feeling of multitude that takes over when you're sitting in a theater. And if you're sitting there glowering when everyone else is laughing, or if you're laughing when everyone else is glowering, you certainly feel alienated. You feel isolated.
Now, I know when you started at Yale, you really wanted to prevent your company from becoming a tryout house for Broadway. Do you still feel that way? And what's wrong with being used in part as a tryout house for Broadway?
I still do feel that way, even though a number of our productions have, with our blessing but without our participation, gone on to New York in one form or another. I think if you're in the business of transferring your productions, either through participation in them or actually, as is now happening, I see with some theaters, producing them, nonprofit theaters are now producing plays on Broadway, you're violating some covenant that was created when nonprofit theaters were first formed. And that is that this was not to be a tributary or a stream that led to Broadway, but rather an alternative to the commercial theater. In the same way that PBS, say, or public television is an alternative to commercial television. It's not meant to compete with it. It's meant to be different so that a variety of tastes can be satisfied and not just that one big mass taste that is satisfied by commercial network television or its equivalent, the Broadway theater. So for us in the resident theater movement to start generating works and looking for works that might have a wider appeal on the Broadway stage is really, I think, a complete betrayal of our mandate. And I'm sorry to see it happen, and I think it's been responsible for the deterioration in our movement.
But isn't it good for Broadway when works get originated at regional theater?
Well, I'm sure it's good for Broadway, and certainly it's good for Broadway producers. They save a lot of money. And as a result, they have been paying a lot of money for to theaters to do this sort of thing. But, you know, you need a long spoon when you start stepping with some of these producers. And I think the spoon has gotten very short. It's true that Broadway has benefited from the appearance of the more serious play on the Broadway stage. On the other hand, it strikes me that the resident theaters have gotten much less daring in trying to produce that compromise between what they might do and what Broadway might do so that both can be satisfied. So what you have really is a situation in which the resident theater is no longer daring, is no longer innovating in the way that it used to in the 60s and 70s in many theaters, I would say most theaters in the country.
My guest is Robert Brustein, and he's the founder and artistic director of American Repertory Theater at Harvard. You started your career as a scholar and as an actor, but you gave up acting. Why?
Good question. I gave up acting, really, because I gave it up when I came to Cambridge. I didn't entirely give it up. Actually, I appeared in my own production of Tonight We Improvise as the director of that play, since I was the director of the play, and I was almost required to play it. But it was a cowardly thing to do. Every time I put my face on stage, the local critics would throw ripe melons at it, so I felt I'd had enough, and I stopped acting. I thought I could expose myself in other ways much more creatively.
Have you ever produced something that you knew was bad? Where the critic in you said, this is not a very good production, and you're stuck with it?
Very often, yes. Not too often, but often. This happens. There's always, you know, something in a production, whether it's mine or someone else's, which I'm unable to fix. I'm unable, let's say, to persuade the director to fix, and it bothers me. And there are productions and plays that I feel I've overestimated or something's gone wrong in the process. And I sit there and shiver a little at the result. And once, even with a play that I will leave unnamed, I actually cut short the run of the play because I thought the play was not finished and it was embarrassing to the theater and to the playwright for it to proceed. But other than that one time, we've always played out our runs, which are short runs, 32, 35 performances, and we stick with what we've done.
I've only left a few seconds for this, but is it a conflict of interest for you to be a producer and a critic?
There are times when these issues do arise. I know virtually three-quarters of the people that I review. They're people I either work with or taught or trained. It's very hard to be disinterested in this regard. And what I have to do is just bite the bullet and risk the friendship or not review the play. I do at least have the option of not reviewing the play or the actor or the director, as the case may be. There are cases when that arises, and I just have to face it head on and announce the conflict of interest and go ahead anyway.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about theater.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Robert Brustein is the founder and artistic director of the American Repertory Theater at Harvard, and his current production is Strindberg's The Father, which will run through March 18th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Laser Man is a new comic thriller about a Chinese-American physicist who discovers his laser research is being used for evil purposes. Coming up, the film's writer and director, Peter Wong, tells us why he gave up laser research to make movies. Also, rock historian Ed Ward explains how unemployment, punk, reggae, and racism all came together in the British ska movement. And book critic John Leonard reviews What I Saw at the Revolution, Peggy Noonan's memoir of her years as a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and George Bush. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that a parent who has custody of a child through a court order may not refuse to produce the child for inspection. The court's ruling came in the case of a Baltimore woman who refused to produce her infant son on the grounds that to do so might incriminate her. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Jacqueline Bonite's son, Maurice, was removed from her home because of his physical injuries and then returned to her by the juvenile court on condition that she undergo therapy and that she cooperate with Baltimore's child welfare authorities. But when authorities visited her home, she repeatedly refused to tell them where Maurice was. The case was referred to the police homicide division. The juvenile court then ordered Bonite to produce the child. She refused and was jailed for contempt. The Maryland Court of Appeals agreed with Bonite that her constitutional right not to incriminate herself had been violated. But today, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, upheld the contempt citation. Writing for the court majority, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said that since Bonite had custody of her child as a result of a court order, she could not refuse to produce the child. But O'Connor went on to suggest strongly that if the child is produced and is either injured or dead, those facts cannot be used against Bonite directly or indirectly in a criminal prosecution. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
Also in Washington, the IRS conceded today that it has not been able to collect billions of dollars in past due taxes. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
IRS Commissioner Fred Goldberg told a House subcommittee today that the IRS is owed $87 billion in delinquent taxes and that it could collect $30 to $40 billion of that amount. Several billion dollars of projected deficit reduction in President Bush's fiscal 1991 budget comes from anticipated management efficiencies that would improve tax collection at the IRS. And Goldberg would like Congress to appropriate more money so that the agency can beef up its collection division. Members of the subcommittee also asked Goldberg about reports that at least one federal agency owes back taxes to the IRS. Goldberg wouldn't say which federal agency was the deadbeat, but he did confirm that a federal department had been included on a list of tax delinquents that owe the IRS over $100 million each. The IRS is not allowed to impose penalties or interest on a federal agency that owes back taxes. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The White House said today that the Secret Service had known last week, when President Bush attended a drug summit in Colombia, that there was a possibility that drug terrorists had surface-to-air missiles. 10 of those weapons were seized yesterday by Colombian police, and 2 men were arrested. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 38.5 points to close at 2,596.85. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The British musical movement, known as two-tone, only lasted from the mid-70s to the early 80s, but it spawned some of the most successful rock groups today. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says he was sorry two-tone didn't survive. There was something pure about the way it all began.
Two-Tone started in Coventry, a city in England's West Midlands that was once the Detroit of the UK. By the mid-70s, though, the British auto industry was dead, and so was Coventry. It had one of the highest youth unemployment rates in England, and because it had been an industrial city, there were many blacks and Asians with the white kids in the unemployment lines. As you might guess, this is also a recipe for racial unrest, as well as an ideal situation for putting together a band. Seeing too much of the former, Jerry Dammers did the latter.
Why must you rest?
Dammers called his band the Special AKA for reasons nobody remembers, and at first their fast tunes were punk and their slow ones were reggae. Since the band was half white punks and half black West Indians, this made a certain amount of sense. But the mixture didn't work live, and after about a year, the two influences had merged. Oddly, they wound up playing ska, a pre-reggae form of Jamaican pop music. But for the most part, they were doing new tunes that they'd written, many of them quite political. They were really popular, and soon there was another integrated ska band in town, The Selector. Specials and The Selector had a mutual admiration society going, so when somebody came along and suggested recording them, it was decided that The Specials would have one side of the single, Gangsters, and The Selector would record the classic instrumental they took their name from on the other side. Then something really weird happened. British youth saw and heard something in all of this, and suddenly, The Specials' tiny two-tone label was selling scads of records. And as it turned out, there were bands all over who were doing this kind of music. In Birmingham, not far away, there was The Beat. And while The Specials were integrated racially, The Selector was integrated racially and sexually, and The Beat were integrated racially and by age, their saxophonist was a 50-something-year-old Jamaican named Saxa. Naturally, it didn't take long for the two-tone idea to hit the capital, and out of Camden Town in the north of London came a group called Morris and the Miners. They changed their name to Madness after a hit by the ska star Prince Buster, and for good measure recorded it as their first single for the two-tone label.
Madness. Madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is losing his brain. Madness, madness, I call it madness.
Madness wasn't integrated at all, and this caused the skeleton in Ska's closet to pop out. In the 60s, when the music was first popular, it had a lot of fans who were skinheads, racist white working class kids who enjoyed beating up Asian immigrants, although for the most part they left blacks alone. The skinheads loved Madness, and this time the skins were affiliated with the National Front, a racist semi-fascist organization. When the skinheads showed up for the Specials and Madness tour, they hurled abuse at the black members of the Specials and made headlines. Madness went to pains to dissociate themselves from the skinheads, and they also dissociated themselves from two-tone, going on to become one of Britain's best-selling groups ever. The Beat also split to form their own label, and their success inspired fellow Birmingham musicians UB40, a reggae band named after the letters and numbers on Britain's unemployment form. All of this had happened over the course of 1 year, 1979 to 80, and of course, it couldn't last.
This time is coming like a ghost town. All the clubs have been closed down. This place is coming like a ghost town.
Now, No matter how well-intentioned the specials were, the racial situation was deteriorating throughout Britain, and there wasn't any renaissance in Coventry. The specials' last single, released in 1981, was a song not only about Coventry, but about the hopes that had risen 5 years earlier with punk and with two-tone after it, and had been dashed by the realities of Margaret Thatcher's Britain.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Peter Wong's first feature film, The Great Wall, was also the first American feature shot on location in China as a co-production with the People's Republic. Wong starred in the film, but he may be better known to you for a smaller role in an earlier film, Chan is Missing. He was the cook wearing the Samurai Night Fever t-shirt who sang Fry Me to the Moon. Wong wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new comic thriller The Laser Man. Their thriller part revolves around a Chinese-American scientist who discovers his laser research is being used for evil purposes. The comedy revolves around the scientist's relationships with people who aren't Chinese but know more about Chinese culture than he does. His mother is Jewish. She believes there's a Chinese soul trapped in her Jewish body. She cooks soy sauce soup with matzo balls. His girlfriend would rather meditate than make love. I asked Wong if he knew people who tried to out-Chinese the Chinese.
Oh, well, I tell you, I met a lot of this kind of persons in big cities in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. They know so much about Chinese cultural oriental things. So we get together with this kind of girls or people around you. I usually talk about baseball.
Why do you talk about baseball and not about China?
Because they know more than they know more about China than I. So what can I say?
Does it embarrass you that you know less, or do you think that they're crazy for knowing so much?
I think I appreciate that. It doesn't embarrass me. I feel happy, and you know, it's very interesting to talk to a non-Chinese who knows so much about it. It's always interesting to learn something from their perspectives. This kind of East meets West thing has been so deeply well developed in this country, which this come back to the message of my film. This should be the future of our world. People start to learn each other's differences. To begin with, they hate each other because they're different. Later on, they like each other because they're different.
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, your movie ends with inter-ethnic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think a lot of people from different racial, ethnic, and religious groups finally feel that you're better off with your own.
Right.
You know, that Jews should marry Jews, that Chinese should marry Chinese, mm-hmm. that blacks should marry blacks, that there's a certain connection that you wouldn't be able to experience, a more intimate connection, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't be able to experience outside your own group. And you're kind of coming down on the opposite side.
That is true. I think eventually what is a Jewish culture, what is a Chinese culture, to be very specifically speaking, I found if I sit down and do a little research, you start to realize a lot of right now we consider as traditional Chinese culture are imported from India, from Europe. So once you open up your mind, you find there's nothing to lose by accepting others. Everything to gain. You know.
I think what people are afraid of losing is their own background, their own a sense of their own history, cultural traditions.
You can never lose that by opening yourself up. If you're born Chinese, you'll start to speak English. You have everything to gain, nothing to lose, you know. You add yourself on. You start to speak Spanish or Japanese. That only make your life more interesting, more colorful.
Can I ask you about your own family?
Yes.
Are you married?
Well, I've been married many times.
Oh, have you?
So let's skip that.
Okay. Do you have children?
Yeah, I have a son. I have a son. He's in college now. He's a good-looking kid. Not too useful, but he's very good-looking.
Now, what's his ethnic background? Part Chinese. That's your side. What's the other side?
The other side is also Chinese. But he talked like a middle-class American or something. He's very good with words.
Did you send him to Chinese school?
No. That's another thing. He speaks Chinese quite fluently. I brought him back to China a few times. I never sent him, forced him to go to Chinese school. I think that's a mistake. Chinese school or any language school, you send the children to study there every weekend or Saturday or Sunday. The kid may be 12 or 11 year old already. They went to this school, sitting there with different people, different age group. And the teacher is trying to teach people to speak like 6-year-old in Chinese. It is quite a torture.
Well, in one of your previous films, A Great Wall, the son in the movie, the American-born son, complains to his Chinese father that, you know, he spent so much time in Chinese school that he never got to watch Bugs Bunny.
That's right. That's right. That's very funny. because we showed a film in certain festivals and met this famous cartoon filmmaker, Chuck Jones, and he caught that line. He enjoyed it very much. She never expected this kind of film people mention about Bugs Bunny, which is a legitimate complaint, tell you.
Now, in The Laser Man, you cast yourself as Lieutenant Wu. Describe the character and tell me why you gave yourself that role.
Lieutenant Lu is a character that I believe, a very commonly observed in the modern cities of the United States. First-generation immigrant, out of necessity, he has to spend so much time on his job. And from time to time, he has to reflect on his own origin, try to trace back his own culture, and got totally confused. And for first-generation immigrants, I observe a lot of this kind of character. And I think I'm a frustrated actor. Nobody want to hire me to play any role in other films. So from time to time, I hire myself to do a role there.
Mm-hmm. Now, another part of the story in The Laser Man is that Arthur is a laser scientist, and he's willing to work on projects without really thinking about what the research is for. But he finds out that the research is sometimes for very dangerous war-related things. Now, you got in trouble with that yourself, I think. You were a scientist.
That's the thing that I sort of been bothered for a long time, because on top of my personal experiences, I think a lot of top-notch scientists and researchers in this country, all over the world, they should face this problem themselves. I think a lot of people in this country, United States and somewhere else, Soviet Union or China, they are diligently developing a very powerful, destructive weapons. Star Wars is one of them. I think they're responsible, but they're not taking that kind of responsibility.
Did you work on a project that you later
found
out was
for? Yes, a long time ago, when I was a graduate student, I worked on a laser research, which is a reconnaissance device mounted on a helicopter using long-wave laser. This is detective kind of a device to try to track down any moving metal objects. That means a tank, a truck, or any person carrying a gun. And then, funny enough, the whole research group never really mentioned about what it is for. After we had a great success of doing all this research, once the target is being identified, what are you going to do with it? Well, this is a legitimate question, but throughout 5 years of research, nobody asked this kind of question in the lab. So that was not a very happy days of my life. I was really torn apart by this.
Is this why you got out of science and into filmmaking?
No, that's not a total reason. I graduated from University of Pennsylvania with a PhD degree in this field, and then I couldn't find a job because I was a foreign student, and also I have a record of anti-Vietnam War. I'll never get my clearance to work on this highly classified, highly sensitive weapon research. Then I turned myself into a computer engineering expert. I worked many years in that field. And it's on the year of 84, I suddenly gone crazy. Maybe I started making films.
Now, I understand that even though you went into science, you really wanted to go into acting, but it was against your father's wishes.
That's right. That's, again, back to this cultural background. I think in Chinese mind, in many Oriental minds, they consider the acting, theaters, entertainment business very lowly. And I think they have, in early days, they have 10 different rankings of what kind of profession you should do. And entertainment business in traditional Chinese ranking is number 9th or something, just one rank above beggars and prostitutes. I think this is horrible. So my father is a very strict and stern scholar. He was a professor in literature. Of course, he highly disapproved of my inclination on acting, which I was very young. I didn't know what I was doing, though.
But you felt you had to obey his wishes.
I thought I was very rebellious and tried to do something different, but I think subconsciously I'm still very Chinese. My father passed away in a year of 1975. Oddly enough, that was the year I was in the United States, started to made my first documentary film. There must be something in there, huh? Some fate or some kind of magic.
Well, Peter Wong, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Peter Wong wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film, The Laser Man. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Václav Havel, the president of Czechoslovakia, is in the United States. He sees the president today. We'll have a report on that and a profile of Václav Havel. Two Supreme Court decisions of importance. One has to do with child abuse. The rights of the child apparently are paramount over the rights of the parent not to incriminate themselves. And a ruling on disability payments for children. The court has ruled that apparently the government has improperly kept hundreds of thousands of children off the disability rolls for the last 15 years.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peggy Noonan has made a name for herself writing for men in powerful positions. She worked first for Dan Rather at CBS News and then at the White House as a speechwriter for President Reagan. She also wrote some of George Bush's presidential campaign speeches. Noonan has written a memoir about her time at the White House. Book critic John Leonard has a review of What I Saw at the Revolution.
The first thing to be said about Peggy Noonan, who stuck around Washington long enough to be lip-synced by two different presidents, is that she's a dandy maker of phrases, often of sentences, sometimes of whole paragraphs. Listen to her justify her job. A great speech, she says, from a leader to the people eases our isolation, breaks down the walls, includes people. It takes them inside a spinning thing and makes them part of the gravity. Listen to her describe the people who got in the way of her doing that job. What I mean is, she says, when men in politics are together, testosterone poisoning makes them insane. She can even be savage discussing hardcore conservatives on her own ideological side. Well, she says, what you get is a bunch of creepy little men with creepy little beards who need something to seethe on. State Department cookie pushers, the Trilateral Commission, some hate to live on. The second thing to be said about Peggy Noonan is that for the purposes of this memoir, and her deliverance from ghosting into a more agreeable career, she's had to invent a literary persona. A sassy cross-circuit of Holden Caulfield and Fran Lebowitz. But right-wing smarty pants, too, like National Review magazine, with some class animus for seasoning, a weakness for the sarcastic, and way too many exclamation marks. This persona works reasonably well, except it sometimes leaves her sounding dumber than she ought to, as if she had to apologize for her copy of Ezra Pound's Cantos, as if she really believed that all liberals are rich and guilty nitwits who went to Harvard and Yale instead of Fairleigh Dickinson, and all activists on behalf of the homeless are cruel manipulators of the insane, and only Republicans can talk to janitors, and Paul Johnson and Jean-Francois Revel are intellectual heavyweights, and George Gilder isn't merely foolish when he babbles about the humane nature of the free market. To have met Gorbachev and to tell us only that he looks like a retired hockey goalie is not just to miss the boat of history, but to jump off after it sets sail, thumbing your nose as you drown. Take that, you commie pinko. The third thing to be said about Peggy Noonan is that almost against her will, she does damage to the president she claims she loves. Reagan's White House is compared to a beautiful clock that makes all the right sounds, but when you open it up, there is nothing inside. Of the president himself, she says that his intellect was only slightly superior to average, that he didn't hear very much of what was said around him, and that the battle for his mind, and I quote again, was like the trench warfare of World War I. Never have so many fought so hard for such barren terrain. Noonan quotes a friend of the president's, "Behind those warm eyes is a lack of curiosity that is somehow disorienting." And so is her memoir, however much fun, somehow disorienting. Her real gripe seems to be that they messed with her copy. If you've seen the movie Reds, you know that that was John Reed's real gripe with the Russian Revolution, too. It always happens to flacks, after which they write for themselves, or they die.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed What I Saw at the Revolution by Peggy Noonan. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Roy Amayak tells us about the traditions of the whale hunt, traditions passed on through his family in Barrow, Alaska. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg on Prince Charles's campaign to save the English language. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.